This is number 12. We've just finished the first act in the book of Revelation, the seven letters, and now we are about to enter into the second act. The second act is about the Lamb and the scroll with the seven seals. Chapter 4 is all of 11 verses. One of the shorter chapters, and it might be the shortest chapter in Revelation. It's kind of an interlude. It depicts a throne scene in heaven. So let's begin by reading through this chapter, 11 verses. After this, I looked, and behold, a door standing open in heaven. And the first voice, which I had heard speaking to me like a trumpet, said, "Come up here, and I will show you what must take place after this." At once I was in the Spirit, and behold, a throne stood in heaven, with one seated on the throne. And he who sat there had the appearance of jasper and carnelian, and around the throne was a rainbow that had the appearance of an emerald. Around the throne were 24 thrones, and seated on the thrones were 24 elders, clothed in white garments with golden crowns on their heads. From the throne came flashes of lightning and rumblings and peals of thunder, and before the throne were burning seven torches of fire, which are the seven spirits of God. And before the throne there was, as it were, a sea of glass, like crystal. And around the throne, on each side of the throne, are four living creatures, full of eyes in front and behind. The first living creature like a lion, the second living creature like an ox, the third living creature with the face of a man, and the fourth living creature like an eagle in flight. And the four living creatures, each of them with six wings, are full of eyes all around and within. And day and night they never cease to say, "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord God Almighty, who was and is to come." And whenever the living creatures give glory and honor and thanks to Him who is seated on the throne, who lives forever and ever, the 24 elders fall down before Him who is seated on the throne and worship Him who lives forever and ever. They cast their crowns before the throne, saying, "Worthy are you, O Lord and God, to receive glory and honor and power, for you created all things, and by your will they existed and were created." So, very vivid imagery. As we've noted previously, the book of Revelation is perhaps written in a dramatic form, almost like a theater production. And what I see here is the scene is changing. You know, when you go to kind of a play or a theater, you might see the backdrops moving in and out, the backdrop coming down or going up. You see transition, and this chapter is definitely one of transition. These, especially in the first half of the chapter, there's a lot of imagery echoes from the first three chapters. And this table here, and at the bottom of the first page and the half of the second page, I've listed some of the echoes that I've recognized. The first is the open door. In chapter 3, verse 8, this is in the letter to the church in Philadelphia. "Now, I have set before you an open door." And in that letter, it was noted that this open door is a door to access God, a door to access the temple, the permanent temple, the true temple that is found in Jesus. And in chapter 4, John is being invited now to come up through this open door. And this voice speaking is like the first voice, the very first voice that John hears in the first vision as it opens. The first voice like a trumpet. This voice says, I will show you what must take place after this, which is very similar to what John was told at the very, John was told at the very beginning of Revelation. But to show to his servants the things that must soon take place. And just like in the first vision of the seven letters, John writes, I was in the Spirit. And he sees a throne in heaven with one seated on the throne. And this is a very similar language to how the seven letters that act closes with, as I also conquered and sat down with my Father on his throne. In the very last letter, the letter to Laodicea. So the act of the seven letters closes with an image of a throne. This next act opens with an image of a throne. What's new, though, in this description is this metaphor, this description of this one seated on the throne using metaphors of jewels and precious stones. And so you might wonder, well, where does that come from? Did John just make these things up and throw it into the description, or did he find this somewhere? And we'll come to that just shortly. The description of the scene continues with 24 thrones, and seated on the thrones were 24 elders. And in the very last letter, it was noted that to the one who conquers, I, Jesus, will grant him to sit with me on my throne. What's interesting about ancient Middle Eastern thrones were, we think of a chair as a throne. The Middle Eastern ancient Greek thrones were much bigger. It was more like a couch. And so it was entirely possible for multiple people to sit on the throne.
It was like an invitation of honor to be able to come sit with that person at his throne.
So that's how the seventh letter described the throne. The difference in chapter 4 is that now, in addition to the main throne, there are 24 other thrones with 24 elders. And these elders are clothed in white garments, and white garments has been mentioned before. For example, in the letter to Sardis and the letter to Laodicea, chapter 3. The one who conquers will be clothed thus in white garments, and in the seventh letter, buy from me white garments. So this theme of white garments continues. These elders also have on their heads golden crowns. And we've already seen that Jesus promises to those who conquer, will be faithful unto death, and I will give you the crown of life. Or hold fast what you have so that no one may seize your crown. Again, this motif of a crown continues. And then flashes of lightning, rumblings and peals of thunder. Burning seven torches of fire, which are seven spirits of God. These go back to the opening, the setup of this opening act, how the scene is set up for the seven letters. His eyes were like a flame of fire. His voice was like the roar of many waters, and seven golden lampstands, and in his right hand he held seven stars. They're not necessarily identical, but very similar imagery continues. So what we know from that is that John is essentially seeing the same thing in the first act as he is now in the second act. The scene is the same. What's new in this description is that before the throne there is a sea of glass like crystal. And when you hear a sea of glass like crystal, you immediately might think all the way to the end of Revelation, you know, the new heavens and the new earth, where it's talking about a sea of glass. So is that what John is referring to, or is there something else? Did he pull that imagery from somewhere else? And we'll see that shortly. So what I've noted is that nearly everything so far in chapter 4 is an echo of what has already been seen. And I don't know about you, but I noted that there seems to be similarities between how the victors are described, the one who conquers in chapters 2 and 3, and the elders of chapter 4. So are they the same people or not? That's a question that I have. Now, the seven letters, so in the first act, the act of the seven letters, the scene was set up as describing Jesus walking on the lampstands, Jesus in heaven, in the temple in heaven. So just as the seven letters were delivered from the throne room of heaven, now that this next act, the second act in the drama, also begins in the throne room. The second half of chapter 4 continues with more details that surround the throne scene. So far, it's been a pretty static description. There is no action. Now the scene, the description zeroes in on what is around this throne. First, there are these four living creatures. Bizarre, fantastic descriptions. Something like you might expect in a contemporary fantasy novel. These bizarre, magical creatures. And as we noted in, right towards the very beginning of the study in Revelation, these fantastic descriptions were not unusual at the time. There were many apocalypses written, and they all tended to use even more exaggerated, fantastic imagery. So, Revelation is actually tame in that regard. Might not think so, but compared to its contemporary literature, Revelation is fairly tame.
Apocalyptic literature at the time.
Yeah.
There
almost seems to be kind of a symbiotic relationship between these four creatures and the 24 elders. Whenever the four creatures give praise, the elders also fall down and give praise. So what we're seeing here is a little more action. It's a scene of worship, praise, and adoration of this being that's seated on the main throne. And there is additional echoes of the preceding scene. Jesus is described as the Alpha and the Omega, who is and who was and who is to come, the Almighty, in chapter 1. And we see similar wording in chapter 4. Holy, holy, holy is the Lord God Almighty, who was and is to come. So it's describing the same being, using the same language, so we can understand that to be describing the same being. So central in this scene is the throne and the worship that surrounds it. Now some caveats as we attempt to interpret this scene and this act is, don't make too much of every detail. Revelation is not an allegory where every little detail has some sort of correspondence and meaning. But rather, John is attempting to describe something that he saw. Again, it's important to set aside what you've heard before, and traditional interpretations in order to hear the passage for as far as possible for the first time. We need to remember that these images are metaphors from the first century and they're not allegories for the 21st. Also, this beast doesn't have a correspondence to some political leader that exists today. There may be applications in certain behaviors, but it doesn't mean that this beast is someone.
In other words, the beast wasn't written to apply to a specific person today.
Correct. It may have had a correspondence in the first century. And if there is, then from the characteristics and the behavior, we can make applications for today. So where is John getting his words to describe this scene? There are similarities that are found in Isaiah 6 and Ezekiel chapter 1. Just to turn to that. Isaiah chapter 6, starting with verse 1. In the year that King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord sitting upon a throne, high and lifted up, and the train of his robe filled the temple. So, got the throne and the temple, which is basically what John is describing in chapter 4. Above him stood the seraphim. Each had six wings. With two he covered his face, and with two he covered his feet, and with two he flew, and one called to another and said, Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. The whole earth is full of his glory. And the foundations of the thresholds shook, and the voice of him who called in the house was filled with smoke. And I said, Woe is me, for I am lost, for I am a man of unclean lips. And I dwell in the midst of a people of unclean lips, for my eyes have seen the King, the Lord of hosts. Then one of the seraphim flew to me, having in his hand a burning coal that he had taken with tongs from the altar. And he touched my mouth and said, Behold, this has touched your lips. Your guilt is taken away, your sin atoned for. So that's some of the imagery, the words, and the phrases that John uses. And we'll see more of that in Ezekiel chapter 1. I'm going to skip down to verse 4. As I looked, behold, a stormy wind came out of the north, and a great cloud with brightness around it, and fire flashing forth continually, like lightning. And in the midst of the fire, as it were, gleaming metal, and from the midst of it came the likeness of four living creatures. And this was their appearance. They had a human likeness, but each had four faces, and each of them had four wings. Their legs were straight, and the soles of their feet were like the sole of a calf's foot. And they sparkled like burnished bronze. Under their wings, on their four sides, they had human hands. And the four had their faces and their wings thus. Their wings touched one another. Each one of them went straight forward without turning as they went. And as for the likeness of their faces, each had a human face. The four had the face of a lion on the right side. The four had a face of an ox on the left side. And the four had the face of an eagle. Such were their faces. And their wings were spread out above. Each creature had two wings, each of which touched the wings of another, while two covered their bodies. And each went straight forward. Whenever the spirit would go, wherever the spirit would go, they went without turning as they went. As for the likeness of the living creatures, their appearance was like burning coals of fire, like the appearance of torches moving to and fro among the living creatures. And the fire was bright, and out of the fire went forth lightning. And the living creatures darted to and fro like the appearance of a flash of lightning. Now as I looked at the living creatures, I saw a wheel on the earth beside the living creatures, one for each of the four of them. As for the appearance of the wheels and their construction, their appearance was like the gleaming of beryl. And the four had the same likeness, their appearance and construction being as it were a wheel within a wheel. When they went in any of their four directions without turning as they went. And their rims were tall and awesome, and the rims of all four were full of eyes all around. And when the living creatures went, the wheels went beside them, and when the living creatures rose from the earth, the wheels rose. Wherever the spirit wanted to go, they went, and the wheels rose along with them, for the spirit of the living creatures was in the wheels. When those went, these went, and when those stood, these stood, and when those rose from the earth, the wheels rose along with them, for the spirit of the living creatures was in the wheels. Over the heads of the creatures there was the likeness of an expanse shining like awe-inspiring crystal spread out above their heads. And under the expanse of the wings were stretched out straight one toward another, and each creature had two wings covering its body. And when they went, I heard the sound of their wings like the sound of many waters, like the sound of the Almighty, a sound of tumult, like the sound of an army. When they stood still, they let down their wings. And there came a voice from above the expanse over their heads. When they stood still, they let down their wings. And above the expanse of their thrones, expanse of their heads, there was the likeness of a throne, in appearance like sapphire. And seated above the likeness of the throne was a likeness with a human appearance. And upward from what had the appearance of his waist, I saw, as it were, gleaming metal, like the appearance of fire enclosed all around. And downward from what had the appearance of his waist, I saw, as it were, the appearance of fire, and there was brightness around him, like the appearance of the bow, as in rainbow, that is in the cloud on the day of the rain. So was the appearance of the brightness all around. Such was the appearance of the likeness of the glory of the Lord. And when I saw it, I fell on my face, and I heard the voice of one speaking. Ezekiel chapter 6. The scene that is set there is almost identical to what's found in Revelation 4. Combine that with Isaiah chapter 6 and
Ezekiel 1 and Isaiah 6.
Ezekiel 1 and Isaiah 6. It basically is describing the very same scene. So throne in the temple, multi-winged seraphim, the song, holy, holy, holy. We've got the storm, the lightning, the four living creatures, human beast composite. Torch fire, jewels, an expanse of crystal, sound of many waters, a throne, a rainbow, all describing the appearance of God. So this sets the scene for God's revelation. This Isaiah 6 and Ezekiel 1, this is the setting in which these two prophets received their visions, their message. And in Revelation 4, it's providing the same function. It's introducing specifically this next act, Lamb of the Scroll. And so John is combining the visions of Isaiah and Ezekiel and telling his audience, telling us that he's seeing what they saw. You know, God's revelations are coming to him just as it did to the prophets of old. He's claiming the same authority that the Old Testament prophets had. Some additional background information here. Jewish mystics, many of whom penned apocalypses, like First Book of Enoch, strove for visions of the invisible God and modeled their views of what they would find on visions of God's enthroned glory in Isaiah 6 and Ezekiel 1. So, John is following the same tradition. So there's nothing new here. In time, these visions were embroidered with every fantastic magnification of the divine glory the mystics could imagine. In contrast to such elaborate reports of the pre-existent throne of God, John's description is simple, like the Old Testament accounts. Why not? We might not think so, but apparently, compared to some of the apocalypses, they were simple. John's description is simple. Like the Old Testament accounts, just enough description to convey the point of God's majesty. The picture of the throne room, including the activity of those surrounding the throne, may also be a parody of the imperial court and the worship in the imperial temples. A daring revelation for a banished Jewish prophet like John. What John is describing is more fantastic, more spectacular than the imperial court. What the Roman emperor has in his court. In regards to this, entering heaven, well, the mystics and the Gnostics emphasize secret knowledge, the obtaining of secret knowledge, such as passwords to access spiritual realms. Well, the contrast here is very different. As John is simply invited to come up. But John isn't trying to somehow reach heaven, but he's invited. The sea of glass, what about that? Well, it alludes to the sea in Solomon's temple. And when the temple, Solomon's temple was being built, they created a big bronze, I believe it was, basin. Humongous thing. That they couldn't weigh because it was so big. And it was called the sea. So, once again, what we see is that Revelation chapter 4 is describing a temple scene.
So it might not be an actual river, it might be a large basin.
But he's describing a scene that is more grand than any of the human efforts that we've seen in their reality at that time.
So it had always been natural to speak figuratively of God's heavenly temple. John's emphasis, given the ancient Near Eastern tradition of the earthly temple reflecting the heavenly one. John's emphasis on worship leads to a portrayal of God's throne in exclusively temple terms. An altar of incense, an altar of sacrifice, the ark, and we've seen that in subsequent chapters of Revelation, which functioned as God's throne in the Old Testament. So the ark that was found in the most holy place, the concept of a temple having a courtyard, a holy place, the most holy place, is not unique to the Hebrew or Jewish cultures. It was just part of the Middle Eastern. All of these, whether they were Canaanite gods, Hebrew gods, etc., they followed similar patterns. And in the most holy place was the throne on which usually the image of the god would reside. But obviously the Hebrews, the Jews, could not make an image. It was the first, second commandment. And so instead they had the throne, the ark. But they, what Solomon said about it was, I'm building this temple for you, but this temple cannot contain you. You are bigger than this temple. The crystal firmament derives from Ezekiel chapter 1, verse 22. The cherubim were covered with eyes. The four creatures had four faces. Bold imagery from Ezekiel. Ezekiel's imagery may be intentionally figurative, but may draw on Babylonian throne and temple imagery and indicate a god greater than any pagans could have conceived. As far as the singing that occurs around the throne, one may contrast the permanently appointed imperial cult choir at Pergamum, where 36 members were to sing hymns in honor of the deified Augustus. So there's precedent within the culture for this choir that sings to a, quote, God. Another note is that the Emperor Domitian, who reigned from about 69 to 79, demanded worship as our Lord and God, but never claimed the role of Creator. Now that's in reference to verse 11 of chapter 4, where the 24 elders sing, "Worthy are you, O our Lord and God, to receive glory and honor and power, for you created all things." The importance of the throne, as a reminder, is that it represents the seat of authority, power, and judgment. So some additional notes as we go into this chapter. So this is really just setting a scene, so there's not a whole lot of, I don't know, theology or interpretation that we need to do. It's more of just reading through it and picturing in our minds the grandness of the heavenly spiritual realities. So first, in verse 1, it's talking about the access to Jesus. The access to God is open. He's the one calling us. He's the one calling His people. And a corollary, as we've noted already, is that we don't have to somehow discover some mysterious means to get up into the heavenly realms. The means is already open. We just have to accept it. And verse 1 also notes that God is going to reveal to John a mystery of what is happening in heaven. As a summary of the first act, the seven letters, one of the things that was noted is that it raises a lot of questions. The seven letters describe what's going on earth. What's happening in the churches. There's a conflict. Jesus is at the center of this conflict to resolve it. The conflict between truth and error and falsehood. So we see what's happening on earth. There's, in some cases, Christians are being pressured to accommodate. There's some persecution. In some cases, some of these Christians have fallen asleep. They're dead. They're lukewarm. So the question is, what's going on in heaven? What is Jesus doing? And what we read is that God is going to reveal what Jesus is doing in heaven to John. Verse 2, we read that John enters, in the Spirit, enters another ecstatic state where he is given a vision. And in this vision, again, the throne is the center and key for all the action that takes place in this act. Verse 3, we read the allusions to Ezekiel chapter 1. What is God like? How do you describe God? And Ezekiel goes into much greater length than John does, but John borrows that same imagery. Verse 4, more thrones. One throne isn't enough. It's 24 more thrones. These elders share the power and authority of Jesus. Again, throne represents power, authority, and judgment. So who are these 24 elders? Option 1 is that they're some kind of angelic beings. But then the question is raised, then what to make of the similarities with those who conquer, the victors of chapters 2 and 3? So option 2 is, they're humans who in some way exemplify the victors of chapters 2 and 3. Then the question is, how in the world did they get there? Because it's being pictured as going on at the same time as the conflict on earth. Well, I think one of the things that we've noticed already is that time and space are compressed in Revelation. You know, we've perhaps, you know, in the past, in more traditional interpretations, there's been some chronological sequence to how Revelation all plays out. But as we've been seeing, time doesn't mean quite as much in Revelation. You know, what is present and future and past all seem to be kind of intermingled and all happening at the same time. So, as a side note, you know, is it talking about quantum physics? Who knows? So perhaps option two, where, you know, they represent humans, those who have conquered. To take that option is best, and to not take the elders' presence in literal heaven too literally. In other words, you know, maybe they're there, maybe they're not, but that's not important. The important thing is that they exemplify the characteristics of those who conquer.
They give a place for people that are living with the relationship of God.
For people who are living in difficulty,
well, this,
to be able to picture that.
The chapter continues in verses 5 and 6, more allusions to Ezekiel 1 and some from Isaiah chapter 6, a description of God in his temple. The second half of verse 6, full of eyes in front and behind. One of the characteristics of God is that God sees all. Nothing is hidden from him. And there's more allusions to Ezekiel 1, Isaiah 6, verses 6 through 8. And in the second half of verse 8, the hymn of praise that begins, "Holy, holy, holy," is very close to what's found in Isaiah chapter 6, verse 3. I think what John's point there is that the same song that was being sung by those creatures back in the Old Testament is being sung at the present time. The song doesn't change. Verses 9 and 10, the creatures and elders are already present. So, no, it's not that the creatures and the elders are entering the scene. They're already there when the scene opens. So again, there's no beginning or end to these creatures and the elders. They're just there. To note is that, you know, the scene opens with one being on the throne, then four living creatures are described, and then 24 elders. So the number increases. And in chapter 5, we'll see that there's going to be a multitude, too many to count. The numbers increase. It's a crescendo that's happening. And the same with the hymn of praise and worship. The first song is, at least in the way it's printed here, two lines. Pretty simple. The second song being sung by the 24 elders is about four lines, a little more complex. And there's going to be, I believe, two or three more songs in chapter 5, and they're going to be even longer as more beings join in these songs. So, like a drama, you know, you might think of, you know, between scenes, what often happens in a theater production or play is you hear music. And there's a dramatic crescendo that's occurring here. So, chapter 4 is part of this setting up for the next act, the scroll with the seven seals. Chapter 4 itself is very static. It just describes. There's not much movement. Chapter 5 begins more of the action.
makes you say, what's going to happen?
Yeah, the actors haven't entered. Now you've got the background people. The background is set. The props are there.
It's more like a narration at this point where it is.
You know, all the minor characters that are part of the prop, basically, part of the scene, are there. But the main actors haven't entered the scene yet. So, you know, this act revolves around the center of God's rule, the temple and the throne. The first act showed the events on earth. Now the perspective moves up to heaven. What's happening in heaven while all of the problems are being seen and experienced down on earth? The summary here is that this is a transitional passage. It closes down the previous scene, but there's still elements that are similar as props move in and out. The backdrop goes, changes. There's similarities. John appeals to earlier visions that Isaiah and Ezekiel saw to communicate to his audience, to John's audience, that he is seeing the same heavenly vision that they saw. The throne and the activities around it are the central themes of this act. Again, God and Jesus is going to be the focus of this act, as is the case for all of Revelation. Revelation is not about heaven or the earth, although they play parts in it. Revelation is about Jesus. And so far in this act, what's central is the praise and worship of God. That's the focus. Now, that's all that these creatures and elders can do. When they see God, that's all they can think of to do.
Well, it's an interesting scene. I believe that the elders is more of a court, like as in, you know, your kings and your court, and it depicts how I personally believe that, you know, you have a group around you always in that situation that is not necessarily your equal, but is your court. And I think that for me, you're still waiting to see where man's place really is, because, you know, as a subject, you're not part of the court. You know, so there's something there that's still more to come with man's relationship and where he fits in that scene as far as where they're going with it. Because it, you know, when you think about how Christ is bringing us back to God and how God created us to be his companion in a sort or whatnot, because the court as a king is not really a very, they're not companions to you, and you cannot, they don't feel for you and you don't feel for them the way that you do as a subject, more so because they're kind of almost an equal or a advisory committee type thing where you're not, it's not the same relationship. So that's kind of what I'm seeing set up there. Pardon me.
Well, and all through God seems to focus on the relationships between the people. Mm-hmm. It's about God, but he's not by himself. He's not isolated. That he's still in relationship with the rest of us. So that's beginning to be depicted as well. I can see why we didn't tell children stories from Ezekiel a whole lot. children would go, huh? Oh, it doesn't make sense. It's weird.
Ezekiel, Isaiah, John, they're trying to describe in human terms with what they know something that is in some ways indescribable. Mm-hmm. So they're doing their best to describe something that, well, this is what I saw. I can't describe it, but I'm going to try.
Yeah, because there is no word for, I mean, we have a word for eternal, but how do you describe eternity, or how do you even look at it when your only vision is a linear beginning, a middle, and an end? You have no concept of how to even describe the possession of the world as a whole at any time and all times.
Describing the setting in which you would find God.
You know, there's a lot of stories in history about, and it seems like it comes from this character, but there's so many stories about a king going outside of his court to find an honest person to engage him in. Mm-hmm. Because his court isn't exactly against him, or isn't exactly, you know... Yeah, anyways, it's not against him. It's not about them not fulfilling him in any way, shape, or form, but it's about finding the people in his as his subjects that want their relationship with him, other than being just the king, you know, the master. They want more than just that. You know, they dress up in bad clothes to go out into the society to see who they might meet. There's so many stories throughout history of that.
Yeah, it's part of the mythology of almost every culture. Uh-huh. You think of the Epic of Gilgamesh of the Mesopotamians. There's, you know, it's part of the god there comes down, and there's a couple that welcome him, basically, and they're the ones that are saved from the flood. Then in the Bible, in the Old Testament, you have God looking for someone who is still righteous, and he finds Noah. And you have similar stories in Greek mythology. I forget exactly which god it was, but... So same thing, basically comes down and walks along, and there's only one couple, I believe it is again, that provides hospitality, and so they are rewarded.
It's such an attractive notion for people who feel unimportant and powerless to imagine their God coming and being with them. And then when you have Jesus... Jesus does just that, but so much more.
Yeah,
so much more.
The earlier mythologies are not false. They're just not complete. Mm-hmm. What John, I think, is describing is that the full truth is found in Jesus. Mm-hmm. He's the one who sees all, but he's also the one who is with all.
There's even more modern stories, even up into the 15th century, of, you know, kings or princes coming to find their real subjects, you know, coming out of the court and out of the kingdom, mm-hmm. and becoming part of society and actually... You know, and actually finding out that there's an actual love for the kingdom that's beyond the fact that he's in charge, and realizing why they need to be a better king, or why that relationship is fostered in the first place or how to keep it going. And I think that that's something that man is always reaching for and always trying to understand. And I think it is the story of Christ.
It's something
it really is.
Humanity needs. And whether you tell it using the name of Cinderella or Jesus or any number of other ways of telling that story.
Yeah, it's also the story of how it's two ways, and it's also how the monarchy becomes detached from his subject also, because his position has become so particular by the subject that they can no longer have any relationship with him anymore. The king is isolated, the court is the only people that he sees, and the subjects have such a high regard for them that there's no way that they can even be in the presence of that. And there's the king stepping off the throne and coming into the society and hiding so that he can just be part of that culture and actually be in the admiration of his subjects. Because in the other version, the way he is in his throne room, he never sees anybody because they're so in their real lives, they're like, we're not worthy, we can't even come into that room to see you. And I think that's an important part of it.
The king stepping out of that setting and entering common life is going to be so reassuring to people who live in that culture.
Well,
to imagine the king stepping out of the setting and being a real person.
It's really, it screams the story of Christ, how, you know, here is this the detached figure that is supposedly loved by all so greatly, but they can't even be in his presence, that he's like, well, I gotta have a way to be part of these people's lives again in this, you know. And then you see the stories where the people that are supposedly, you know, the chambermaids of the prince or princess that leaves, is everybody's distraught and they don't know what happened, where the king is, you know, and then they it's an interesting correlation how all those stories came out of this, and then there's the one story that's always been there saying the same thing.
Why we need Cinderella. I like it. Lots of stories, but that's the one that...
And it's funny, too, is they always have somebody that, like, helps them, you know, because they don't know how to really be there, you know, they're not used to, they don't even understand that, you know, that their society is a little bit cruel and they get out into it and there's always somebody that saves them or helps them, and it's just, you know, it's kind of amazing that...
I like it.